Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Yes, it's that time again. The torch is on its way to Vancouver, and if you have $700 or so, you could be in the audience to see the Olympic cauldron set aflame. 2,500 athletes from 82 nations and billions of fans worldwide cheering their nation's skaters and skiers. But the games mean something different to everyone, and if you check out the blogs, you get a pretty mixed bag of topics. Why Wayne Gretzky shouldn't light the cauldron, snowboarder Shaun White playing loud guitar in the athlete's village, and from the LA Times, whether or not the Olympic torch looks like a joint. The games will run for more than 2 weeks, and it's impossible to watch everything. We've got some hints on what's worth seeing and talking about on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Friday, February 12th, and the takeaway for me is, you know, as a child growing up in Southern California, the Winter Games were like fairy tale land, like this whole other world where people had snow.
The world sledding party.
Yeah, I wanted to be in the sledding party. Yeah. You can't sled on the beach.
All right. Well, you could be in the sledding party if you're an Olympic athlete, but let's get right to the top stories we're following this morning. He's not going to be doing any sledding anytime soon. Former President Bill Clinton expected to leave a New York hospital today after yesterday's procedure to unblock a clogged heart artery. His cardiologist, Dr. Alan Schwartz, says the two new stents that they installed should fix the problem.
This was not a result of either his lifestyle or his diet, which have been excellent. He's exercised regularly. He's in excellent condition.
The president could be back to work as early as Monday. 1 month ago today, the earth shook for 40 terrifying seconds in Haiti, leaving around 200,000 people dead and leveling most of the capital city. It's a national day of mourning today, with a ceremony to be held in the ruins of the National Palace in Port-au-Prince. Earlier on The Takeaway, we spoke to Rico Dupuy, who runs a Haitian radio station, Radio Soleil, here in New York City.
This earthquake has hit not the country of Haiti, but the Haitian nation, which is formed of Haitians in Haiti and Haitians overseas in the diaspora.
At 4:53 Eastern, the exact time the earthquake hit, what Rico calls the Haitian nation is being asked to kneel and pray.
A disturbing story out of Ohio. A new report on human trafficking estimates that about 1,000 American-born children are forced into the sex trade in Ohio every year. It also says about 800 immigrants are sexually exploited and pushed into sweatshop-type jobs. Celia Williamson joins us. She's a professor in the University of Toledo's Social Work Department, and she's leading the research efforts at the Ohio Trafficking in Persons Study Commission, which published its latest report on Monday. Celia, people don't often associate human trafficking with American cities. How big of a problem is this in the United States?
Oh, I think we're just starting to uncover that it's a large problem here.
And is it possible that a kid can get involved in this without a parent knowing?
Oh, yeah. There are several trafficking techniques used to manipulate and really trap youth into the sex trade.
Okay, we're going to talk about this more with Celia Williamson in just a moment.
For the first time in 50 years, a Kennedy will not be serving in Congress. Here's a clip from a video that will air over the weekend from Rhode Island Congressman Patrick Kennedy, son of the late Ted Kennedy.
Now, having spent two decades in politics, my life is taking a new direction, and I will not be a candidate for re-election this year.
Patrick Kennedy served 8 terms in Congress.
And let the games begin. The Winter Olympics in Vancouver
really
start today with the first ever indoor opening ceremonies tonight. Good things it's indoors because the forecast calls for rain, not snow. We're going to be talking to you about some of the people behind this year's games, like the first black skating pair ever in the Olympics. But we're asking you, what event would you want to compete in if you were in the Olympics? John, what event would you want to do?
The luge for me, for sure.
The bobsled. Bobsled, totally. You can even make up your own event if it's not an actual Olympic sport. Let us know at 8778-MYTAKE or post it to our website. TheTakeaway.org.
Quick on the markets, Asian and European markets mixed. Futures are down. The Dow starts at 10,144. The S&P opens at 1,078. And the NASDAQ opens at 2177. Coming up, more on that disturbing story out of Ohio on human trafficking.
You You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
You know, when I read the results of a report on human trafficking yesterday, I thought I'd read it wrong. It said about 1,000 American-born children are forced into the sex trade every year. And I expected that to be 1,000 every year out of the nation. That's 1,000 in the state of Ohio alone. It's a stunning statistic. Joining us to talk about it again is Celia Williamson, a professor at the University of Toledo. She is leading research efforts at the Ohio Trafficking in Persons Study Commission that published that report on Monday. And we also have Teresa Flores with us. She was an actual victim of human trafficking, and she's author of the book The Slave Across the Street, the true story of how an all-American teenager survived the world of human trafficking. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Celia, this report that you have issued, like I said, I thought that would be 1,000 out of the country. That's 1,000 out of Ohio. What do these numbers look like when you spread them across the country?
Well, there's been several estimates. The government's estimate has been about 17,500, but their study methodology is very elusive and not very well done, even admitted by them. Other studies have been over 72,000 just coming through the southwest border as international victims. And then there hasn't been a large study done in a meaningful way in terms of domestic children, American-born children, but the estimates are about 100,000.
What is the typical story here? Who is this that is victimizing children, and what are they forcing them to do?
Well, I think they're organized. Well, I know there are organized sex trafficking rings happening around the nation, and they're manipulating and forcing children into the sex trade. And it has become the second largest illegal enterprise in the world, human trafficking, and it's a booming business in the U.S.
Teresa, you were actually a victim of sex trafficking. This began when you were 15 years old. Can you tell us how this began and how you got trapped into continuing this?
It really, you know, the same way it happens now is I was vulnerable and I moved around a lot. So I didn't have a really good support network around me. I didn't have, you know, aunts and uncles or grandparents that I could talk to or that would notice any of the red flags, any of the changes in me. And, you know, was just targeted by a group of men who saw this, and they used a technique that is very common even today, in that they showed, you know, one of them showed me a lot of attention, and, you know, it's called grooming, where they give you a lot of love and tell you how wonderful you are, and then something very simple. They just offered me a ride home from school one day and ended up taking me not to home but to his home, and giving me a pop that was laced with some sort of drug, and raped me. And then I found out later that they there was other people there, and they had taken pictures of the rape, and then essentially blackmailed me into earning them back.
So this was a young man that you thought was going to be a boyfriend, and in fact it got you into the sex trade because he threatened to show these photos of you to your parents and to the school, and your parents did not know this was going on. How is that possible?
It's very, you know, very possible, very easy. When your life is on the line and someone's telling you that they're going to kill you and your family, you go to all lengths to keep that quiet, so it was very easy to keep that from them.
But how did it work? Were you going out and doing this activity with your parents not knowing? How did that actually function?
What happens is I had a private phone in my room, and so they would call my room. And my dad traveled a lot, so he was gone about 3 weeks out of the month on business. And you know, my mom was the kind of mom that when you went to bed, you said goodnight and you went into your rooms and you shut your door and you saw each other the next day. And so they would call my room and say, you need to appear immediately. And so I would essentially just sneak out and go to a different street behind my house, and a car and driver would be waiting.
Celia, we should point out that Teresa Flores, that we're hearing her story right now, she was from Detroit, but we're talking with you about the problem in Ohio. And I'm wondering, first of all, is Teresa's story typical? And number two, how are we dealing with this problem Have we lost Celia? Okay, that's the sound of static. Teresa, can you tell me, I mean, you've become an activist on this issue. How do we deal when we find out cases of human trafficking? What happens to these girls?
Well, say that again, when we find the cases?
When we find these cases, how does it work through our system?
You know, that's a good question, because we know that the FBI knows that they're there, law enforcement, but it's really difficult because there's no place to put them once we get them and rescue them. So there's very few social services and shelters and places out there to take them to. So they usually end up in jail, like detention center, or into a foster care home.
We have Celia Williamson of the University of Toledo back. Celia, is our system set up? I mean, we don't obviously have good research on this issue, but is our legal system, our law enforcement system set up to take care of this problem?
Absolutely not. Actually, I went to a meeting in Washington, D.C. about this issue across the U.S., and one of the main problems was that the criminal justice, the social service, and the healthcare system are not educated about this issue. They don't know how to identify victims, and they are our first responders. But on top of that, when our child victims are rescued from trafficking, they're often incarcerated in detention centers across the U.S., despite the fact that under the Trafficking Victims Protection Act, which is a federal law that says any child under the age of 18 that is involved in prostitution is a victim of the crime of human trafficking, cities across the U.S. are still incarcerating our kids.
Well, Teresa Flores is now the director of awareness and training at Grace Haven. That's a shelter for girls that's not quite opened yet. Teresa, do you have advice for parents on how to keep this from happening to their own kids?
Yeah, I mean, there are red flags, and they need to find out what those are and look for them and be observant and just keep good communication open with their child. If you see something, you know, don't assume that it's just a teenager, you know, going through hormones. You know, ask and find out where they're going and check on them in the middle of the night. You know, you have to get up in the middle of the night and see if they're in their bed. I mean, it's just simple things like that.
Be nosy with your children, I guess. Teresa Flores was a victim of trafficking at age 15, author of the book The Slave Across the Street, and Celia Williamson, professor in the University of Toledo's Social Work Department. It's 15 minutes past the hour. Now let's check in on the headlines.
A month after the earthquake in Haiti that killed around 200,000 people, the government has declared a national day of mourning. Meanwhile, the United Nations says more than 15 countries will send an extra 3,500 troops to Haiti to beef up security and help with aid delivery. Also, several large circus tents previously used by Cirque du Soleil are on their way to Haiti to be used as temporary headquarters for the government. Here at home, former President Bill Clinton has just been released from a New York hospital following surgery yesterday. Dr. Alan Schwartz, who's treating the president, says he's in good shape.
The procedure went very smoothly. President Clinton has since been up and walking around and visiting with his family. He's in good spirits.
Secretary of State Hillary Clinton delayed her departure to the Middle East to be with her husband. She'll now leave tomorrow.
In Georgia, a soldier who refused to be deployed to Afghanistan will not face a court-martial. Alexis Hutchinson is a single mother and argued that she had no one to care for her infant son. She's facing demotion and will lose all military and veteran benefits. Finally, folks from Louisiana to coastal South Carolina are bracing for a rare winter storm, something many haven't seen in a decade or longer, snow. That same storm already left Dallas with 9 inches of snow. That's a look at some of the stories that we're watching this morning. Coming up, John, you think you call it the world's gigantic sledding party?
Sure.
The Olympics, the Winter Olympics begin today. And we're asking you, what event would you want to compete in? And if it's not a real event, you can make up one of your own.
There's some wacky ones in the Winter Games.
Absolutely. Sure. Let us know at 8778-MY-TAKE, or you can post it to our website, thetakeaway.org. We'll kick off a look at the games with a look at what bloggers are talking about in just a few minutes.
What's your take? Leave a comment at thetakeaway.org or call us toll free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. You know, much to the chagrin and possible alarm to people over at NBC Sports, NBC Sports, of course, is an exclusive broadcaster of the Winter Olympic Games, which kicks off this evening, that during the 2 weeks of relentless action we're going to see at the Olympics, there's going to be relentless coverage, and not all from NBC. No, with the penetration of Twitter and Facebook, aligned with certainly the proliferation of blogs around the world, there will be constant coverage of the results and the strategy and the setup of the Winter Olympics. And we have three people who are going to be part of that coverage. Ski instructor and yoga teacher Leilani Gibson joins us. She has a blog called Ski Like a Girl, where she talks about women skiing, and she joins us from her home in Oregon. Good morning, Leilani.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Brandon Horley is the hockey editor for SBNation.com. He joins us from Connecticut. Brandon Horley, I gather your blog is all about hockey, right?
SB Nation, it covers all sports, but I particularly am the hockey editor, yes.
And from Vancouver, we have Aaron Harris, who won an all-expense-paid trip to Vancouver, where he's going to be blogging about the games, and he joins us from his hotel. His blog is called Axles, Loops, and Spins. You can find the links to all their blogs on our website, thetakeaway.org. Welcome, Aaron.
Good morning.
So what's the top story on your blog this morning?
It's just that I'm here, and I'm ready to start blogging about the Olympics.
And say that again?
It's just that I'm here and I'm ready to start blogging about the Olympics.
And Brandon Worley, I butchered your name twice there this morning. I gather you spell it right in your blog. What's your top story?
Well, right now we just have a couple of previews previewing the women's and men's hockey. So we're just previewing it and getting ready for the games to start next week.
And Leilani Gibson, do you consider yourself a competitor to more traditional media covering the games? Or... Something more, something value-added.
I wouldn't say I'm a competitor, and I hope that I do add some value. My blog is definitely, you know, just my opinion and my take on things. And, you know, right now it's Lindsey Vonn all the way. And, you know, I mean, I definitely got into the Sports Illustrated thing, had the bikini pictures up and that sort of thing. So I used to think of myself as a feminist until I started posting all the athletes in their swimsuits. And I'm like, you know, whatever. It's getting skiing out there. It's getting, you know, the sport out there. So, you know, that's what I'm doing.
And, well, talk about the events that most concern you, since you are, as you say, kind of a full-service blog, Leilani Gibson.
Definitely focusing on the alpine skiing and the freestyle skiing. As far as freestyle skiing goes this year, there's the new event, Ski Cross, which has actually been around in the X Games, a skier cross. But, you know, Ski Cross has been compared to, like, sort of a roller derby on the snow. It's not really a contact sport, but somehow it manages to be.
Yeah, well, it absolutely does, and people get seriously injured. Brandon Worley, do you think there's a good marriage between some of these X Game sports and the traditional sports like hockey and the Winter Olympics?
I think it's made it more interesting. You know, hockey's always been part of the Winter Olympics, but now you're starting to see, you know, like the ski cross, and you're starting to see the, you know, snowboarding become a much bigger part of, you know, the Winter Olympics. And I think it makes it more exciting.
And let's take a look at the matchups in the sort of hockey sphere here. Who is the favorite going in, and how much are these national teams mirrored in the NHL?
Well, on the men's side, the men's hockey is made up primarily of NHL players. The NHL is allowing the players to become part of the national teams. So you're starting to see, you know, a lot of NHL superstars are on the teams, and it just and the best countries are usually the countries who can have the most NHL players on their team. So you have Team Canada is usually the favorite. You know, Team Sweden is right behind, and some say Team Sweden and Team Canada are neck and neck for being favorites to win gold, and that's followed, you know, right up by, you know, Finland, Switzerland, and the United States.
And Sweden, Canada, if that turns out to be the gold matchup, I mean, is the world going to just hold their breath on that, like U.S., Russia years and years ago?
I don't know if the world will hold their breath. I think, you know, everyone it would want a big gold medal matchup between, you know, United States and Canada, because those would be the two countries that are you know, really fighting for the world power in hockey right now. The problem is United States is putting a team on the ice that's very young and very inexperienced. So not many people think that the United States are going to be able to get there, get that far this year.
So, Aaron Harris, your blog is a little more personal. I'm wondering, in the blog trade, do you have to worry about using the word awesome a little too much in each individual blog?
I don't think you can ever use the word awesome too much.
How did I know you would say that? What events are you most interested in? What's your angle here?
Well, the event that my blog will be, at least my figure skating blog will be most interested in, is, of course, figure skating. And I'm just looking at following the skaters here. And, you know, I don't really have an angle. It's just whoever is doing the best after the short program and the free program. So those are the skaters I'll follow.
The skaters. Jed writes on our site, my fantasy event is that they will make a second biathlon, one that combines target shooting with ski jumping. That will get the ratings up. Any thoughts on that, Leilani? A biathlon with ski jumping.
Maybe Leilani has a fantasy event.
That would be great, though. You could actually shoot while you're on the jump.
That would be wild. As you're spinning around, I don't know. I think there's some issues there with, you know, fans.
You think?
Of course there's issues, but I'm actually surprised that the X Games hasn't already thought of that.
That's a possibility. I don't know. I'm all about bringing back ski ballet if I could bring back a sport. That's what I want. I mean, if you call it a sport.
There used to be an Olympic sport called ski ballet.
I don't know that it was an Olympic sport, but as far as skiing goes, ski ballet, it was more on the snow and dancey. So it kind of combined Aaron's ice skating thing with my ski thing all in one sport.
All right.
You know, it would work. We could blog about it, Aaron.
Leilani Gibson blogs about women skiing. Brandon Worley, do you hope to get under NBC Sports craw at all during your coverage?
We really don't get into all that. We just primarily cover the sport.
Just
so
cover the sport. Do your job. Brandon Worley blogs about men's hockey, and Aaron Harris is blogging from Vancouver. You can find links to their blogs on our website, thetakeaway.org. Let the blogs begin. Thanks, guys.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, we try to peer through the government-generated information haze in Iran to figure out the state of the opposition and the Iranian government after yesterday's demonstrations. But right now, let's check in on some top news stories at 30 minutes after the hour. In the past 15 minutes, former President Bill Clinton left the New York City hospital following yesterday's heart procedure. His cardiologist gave him an excellent prognosis.
I told him he could be back in the office on Monday.
Clinton reportedly took a conference call on earthquake relief in Haiti just before being wheeled in for his angioplasty yesterday. It's a national day of mourning in Haiti to mark the one-month anniversary of the earthquake, which left around 200,000 people dead and a million homeless. A ceremony will be held in the ruins of the National Palace in Port-au-Prince, near a huge refugee camp. A Haitian judge has ruled that the 10 American missionaries charged with kidnapping children should be released while the charges are investigated. The group will still have to spend the weekend in prison because under Haitian law, the prosecutor gets a chance to contest the decision.
On Capitol Hill, Senate Democrats are proposing a new stripped-down jobs bill. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid says it isn't a one-shot deal.
We don't have a jobs bill. We have a jobs agenda.
The bill will have tax breaks for small businesses that hire new workers at a cost of $15 billion over the next 10 years. Senate Democrats have also launched a counterattack against last month's Supreme Court decision allowing uncontrolled corporate spending in elections. Senator Charles Schumer says a proposed bill would prevent foreign-owned companies or their subsidiaries from paying for election ads.
Foreign leaders like Hugo Chavez and regimes like the Chinese should have no backdoor ability to undercut our democracy.
Before leaving for the President's Day break last night, the Senate confirmed by unanimous consent more than two dozen of President Obama's nominees to federal positions. And the man credited with inventing the Frisbee has died. Walter Morrison originally called his flying disc the Pluto Platter back in 1957. It was later renamed. I can't imagine why. Sales topped $200 million. Morrison was 90 years old. Let's take a look at the markets. Asian and European markets are mixed, but futures are down. The Dow will start at 10,144. S&P opens at 1,078 and the NASDAQ starts at 2,177. Those are some of the stories that we're following this morning.
So yesterday, a lot of the media was focused on Iran, where there were demonstrations on both sides, pro and anti-government, for the 31st anniversary of the beginning of the Islamic Revolution that transformed Iran, certainly transformed the Middle East, and has been a theme in U.S.-Iranian relations, of course, ever since. Joining us now to sort of take a look at what happened yesterday and try to figure out what it means for going forward is Siavash Ardalan, host of the BBC Persian TV's interactive show, Your Turn. He's been covering Wednesday's protests for our partner, the BBC, and the BBC Persian TV is based in London, where he joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Also, Gary Sick, an Iran expert at Columbia University with long experience analyzing and studying Iran, also joins us from New York City. Gary, good morning.
Good morning.
First of all, Gary Sick, what did you make of what happened yesterday? Is it possible to score the opposition and the government? It seemed as though the government was able to project that it has the upper hand here.
I think there's no doubt about it. I mean, the government won this battle, and part of, I think the only reason why they won the battle is that they have actually mastered some of the techniques. They've learned how to really turn off the internet quite effectively. They had their troops out in very strategic locations. They jumped on every small demonstration the moment it began to appear. They beat up leaders of the opposition when they tried to make an appearance. And at the same time, they bust in massive numbers of people for a show of force. And it was a one-sided operation. And I think the opposition is going to have to rethink itself.
Siavash Ardalan from the BBC Persian TV service. Yesterday on this program, Stephen Kinzer, who's written a lot about Iran, suggested that there's a constraint and dynamic going on in the opposition that, based on the experience of the Islamic Revolution, Iranians fear another big revolution and fear perhaps the pendulum swinging all the way in the other direction here. And as a result, they're inclined to go much more cautiously. Do you buy that theory?
Well, this is really the essence of the soul-searching that's going on right now among the Green Movement. Many of them are supporting this idea, including its leader, Mir Hossein Mousavi, himself being a revolutionary. He now supports the idea of reform and is emphasizing that we're not trying to overthrow the government. What we're simply pursuing are reforms within the Constitution. If there's any changes in the Constitution that are to be made, it should be done through peaceful means. Yet, the Green Movement, you know, covers a vast array of predispositions and of political thinking, many of them also inclined towards more violent upheaval. And this is a conversation that's going on amongst them as we speak.
Gary Sick, is reform possible given the constraints within the Iranian government and the kinds of crackdowns that you've already talked about?
Well, I think what we're seeing is that the opposition started out being very mild, actually calling for rather small reforms and small changes. They have become more and more demanding as time goes on and as the repression has grown. And I think what's going to happen now is either that the regime permits a reformist group to actually operate as an opposition, or you're going to see it go underground even more and become more radical and be taken over by people who really do want to overthrow the government and will do so violently. I think the tactics of the government are understandable in the sense that they've discovered how to actually manage repression effectively. But I think in the short term that may help them, but in the long term it actually undercuts their legitimacy, and that is essentially that's their strongest card, mm-hmm. and they're losing that all the time.
And, a nuclear physicist will tell you that crowing about having 20% enriched uranium is kind of like crowing about having a bunch of X-ray machines. It's not even close to what it would take to make weaponized uranium. Nevertheless, President Ahmadinejad yesterday declared Iran a nuclear power because of this 20% enriched uranium. Does he have an argument, and does it resonate with the people?
I believe this is the third time he has announced that Iran is a nuclear nation, so I don't think there's anything new in that. This is something that he trots out every time there's a major national holiday. Basically, they can enrich uranium to 20%. They can go beyond that if they want to. The trick is not to sit back and say, oh my goodness, they must be building a bomb because they've got half a gram of enriched uranium, but to say, all right, how do we stop them from going on from here? And I think that's the point where the West and the United States really don't, they haven't got an answer to that.
Siavash Ardalan, finally, you know, you talked about an internal conversation that's taking place within the opposition. I'm wondering if the techniques that Gary Sick has talked about of controlling the information flow, particularly in the internet, are lessons that are maybe drawn by other nations, say China, even the U.S., in trying to control information. This was an unprecedented moment yesterday.
Absolutely. I think as time goes on, as the state realizes how are the best ways to deal with the opposition, they're learning their lessons. And yesterday showed that they've done their homework as well, bringing down the internet connections down to a crawl, and not just with the internet connection and the you know what's going on in cyberspace, but the country has virtually changed into a police state over the past few weeks. They've just embarked on this massive campaign of intimidation and arresting journalists, bloggers, minorities, and people we don't even sometimes hear about because their families don't want news of it to be leaked. So the government is learning how to repress the opposition better, but the opposition has a problem of trying to find different ways, creative ways of dealing with this. And so far, the best idea they've come up with so far has been to try to hijack some of these state-sanctioned anniversaries.
Right.
And come out to the streets. But I think they've exhausted this method.
Siavash Ardalan, host of the BBC Persian TV's program, Your Turn. Gary Sick, is President Ahmadinejad out of the woods here in the moments before we go?
Absolutely not. He's
Absolutely
being
not.
Opposed by people in his own party and is anything but a popular figure at this point.
More to come. Gary Sick, Iran expert at Columbia University, talking about yesterday's 31st Islamic Revolution anniversary protests.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee. The fashion world lost an icon yesterday. Authorities found British fashion designer Alexander McQueen dead in his apartment in London. They suspect suicide. When McQueen started his career in London, Savile Row, the hub of old-school English tailoring, he said he spoke himself on a show called The Frank Skinner Show when he was 27 years old. And here's McQueen describing himself for being a little bit, what he says, cheeky.
I'm in Savile Row with a load of old tailors, and you start padding the canvas, which makes the jacket. It just happens to be Prince Charles's jacket I was working on at the time. And so I draw this big willy on it.
Here to talk about the legacy is New York Times fashion critic Kathy Horn. She wrote a lengthy profile about McQueen last year. Kathy, give us an idea of who Alexander McQueen was. Many people may know him for designing the lobster shoes that Lady Gaga wore in her video Big Romance, but who was this man?
Well, he was a complicated guy who grew up in the East End of London. His father was a taxi driver. He was very close to his mother, Joyce, who just passed away about a week ago. He went to Central St. Martin's, which is one of the top schools in London, but as you heard on that clip, he was also trained on Savile Row. You know, he was a very smart guy who could be very funny, very brash with people, super hardworking guy, I think a very hard partier too if he wanted to. And then of course the fashion world, we knew him for these incredible shows that he did over the last 15 years. I think that he was really just he was one of those really exceptional people in the business for being intelligent and also being incredibly capable with his hands. So he got the conceptual part of fashion, that fashion was more than just wearable clothes, but at the same time he could make anything. He did his own patterns.
His runway shows were known for being more performance art than just a strict fashion show, and yet he was himself a kind of a modest individual coming from working class backgrounds, and he wasn't necessarily one of the outsized fame seekers that we know of in the fashion world.
Well, I think he's the real deal. I think he was a super talent, and I think when Lee, everybody knew him as Lee because that was his first name. When Lee was very interested in the work, he loved going into the studio. He loved working with all those people, getting the things done, making things the way he wanted to. I think he thought a lot about being the 21st century designer. And as you said, he was a really kind, decent, super sensitive, nice guy. He told you what he thought about stuff. He didn't hold back on anything like that. But I think that was one of the I wouldn't know if it was whether it's a conflict or a dichotomy in Lee that he did come from this working class background. He did spend almost all of his life until the last year or two living in the East End of London. His business was still based there, although he did show in Paris for a while. He worked for the House of Givenchy, a couture house. So he certainly knew a lot of the really good contemporary British artists. So he could travel in that world. He could work at the very heights of fashion.
And his death has cast a somber mood over New York Fashion Week, which began this Wednesday. Reports of a possible suicide on the part of British designer Alexander McQueen. That is Kathy Horn. She's the fashion critic for our partner, The New York Times.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headley here with John Hockenberry. Coming up, an interesting story on two levels. Number one, the first black figure skating pair is going to be competing in the Winter Olympics that begin today. And the other thing is how they met. Think of Match.com or eHarmony. First, though, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. Former President Bill Clinton has been released from the hospital in New York after treatment for a heart condition. They say his condition right now and his prognosis is good. In other news, Haiti observes a national day of mourning today, according to mark the 1 month since the devastating earthquake that killed around 200,000 people and left a million homeless. The government there has urged people to wear black or white and to show respect for the dead.
So snow may not be falling at the Winter Games in Vancouver, but it is expected in southern cities like Charleston, South Carolina, which wanted the Olympics but didn't get it, right? And Savannah, Georgia, cities which haven't seen snow in about 10 years. What's going on here? Paul Kosin from the National Weather Service in Washington, D.C. What is going on? In the south, there's snow. In Vancouver, there's not.
Well, they're often tied together because what's known as a ridge trough pattern, a ridge in the western United States suppresses snow, and a trough in the east coast enhances snow, combined with some very cold temperatures that resulted in the huge snowstorms across the mid-Atlantic states. Virtually everyone that missed the storm to the south, these past storms of the last week, the south will now make up with it. Everyone south of that area now will be picking up snow from Texas all the way to North Carolina.
That's an argument for not letting the IOC choose the Winter Olympic city, but waiting until the weathermen decide where the snow is going to fall in that season. Paul Kosin from the National Weather Service in D.C., thanks so much. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Ask any pairs figure skater, and they'll tell you that sometimes finding their match on the ice is more complicated and more difficult than finding a match off the ice. That's why there's actually an online pairs figure skating introduction site. It's like a match.com, but it's exclusively for skaters who are looking to find a skating partner. And that's how our next guests met. Vanessa James and Yannick Bonheur were set up on icepartnersearch.com. They're about to compete in their first Olympic match as a team. They are the French national champions. They're skating for France this weekend, and they will be the first black pairs skating team ever to compete in the Olympic Games. Vanessa, let's start with you. Can you explain to our listeners what makes finding a match so difficult that you had to turn to a kind of blind dating sort of website in order to find your partner, Yannick?
There are so few boys, actually, in figure skating, and also there are few boys that are strong enough or tall enough or experienced enough. So it is difficult. We have more girls in figure skating than boys, so it's always difficult to find a boy and then someone that you're compatible with. So
kind of the same problem we all had in fourth grade square dancing class, right?
Exactly.
So Yannick, Vanessa flew out to France, and she did an audition with you. How did that audition go?
Really good. First impression was perfect. We was really connected together. I felt something with Vanessa. It was really great.
How did you know she was the one? You got a few responses from the website.
Yes, I was a few responses from a Canadian or U.S. girl. But at the beginning, doesn't work, and we saw Vanessa. I saw a few videos from her, and when we get on the ice and try a few elements, I knew it was her.
Vanessa, did you have the same instant connection?
Yes, we both We both knew that we wanted to skate together within the first day of skating together. And after the first 3 days, it was perfect, and we had already made our decision. We always laughed. All the elements worked really well, and we both looked very nice. We have really good lines on the ice.
But you had an accident during your early training, isn't that right?
It was the first day I came back to France to actually... I cut his hand the first day, just before we were about to finish practice. We were actually in the middle of a spiral sequence, and I had to let go of my foot, and his hand just happened to be there. It was in my way.
That's not the most auspicious way to start a partnership together, but I guess it turned out pretty well. You guys experienced success pretty early on.
We've only been skating for 2 years, and at the Olympics we'll be competing against couples that have been skating together from 5 years to 15 years. So we have accomplished a lot. We've done 2 European championships and world championships where we got our place for the Olympics this year.
Now, because of the changing rules in terms of nationality and country of origin, we see all kinds of pairs of skaters who are born in different countries, hold multiple citizenships. And Vanessa, you're a really good example for that. Can you kind of give us an idea of your international status?
Yes, I have identity crisis. I was actually born in Canada. I have British citizenship through my parents, who are both British. And we've been living in the U.S. for about 10 years now. And I moved recently 2 years ago to France, and I now have French citizenship.
So do you feel any sense of, I guess, dislocation in terms of what country you're actually skating for and representing in the Olympics?
Yes. I wasn't sure what country I wanted to skate for because I had the opportunity to skate for many. I'm proud to represent France. I was very welcome to skate there, and I have Yannick's family, who was very loving, and I spent Christmas with them. And all of France has been very supportive, and I found my perfect partner. So
Yannick, you were not looking to find a black partner. You were just looking for somebody with the athleticism and the kind of relationship that you needed. But you ended up with another black skater, and you're now going to be the first black figure skaters to perform as a team in the entire history of the Olympics.
Yes. That's true. The first time I just watch and search for a partner, and I found Vanessa. She's a black girl, but the first impression, we didn't think about that. And it's true now, everybody talk about first black pair in Olympic, and we are actually really proud about that, and we won't like push the pair skating for black, because there is no many, and we think we can arrive and be good.
Yeah.
Vanessa, can you tell me about what that moment was like? Maybe it was the moment when somebody first pointed it out to you or first asked you about it. How do you feel as the first black figure skaters in the Olympics? Was that a moment where you kind of went, whoa, wait, am I?
Yeah, we didn't really know if we were the first, because we know we have seen other black skaters in the sport, like there's Robin, he's a German black skater, pair skater also, skating with a Ukrainian girl. There was also Sergey Bonnelly from France. But yes, when people told us we were the first, we were surprised but very proud. And like Yannick said, we want to encourage other people to skate and to be the best in skating, because it is rare to see black skaters on the ice.
Do you feel like it puts pressure on you? I mean, there's going to be the eyes of thousands, perhaps millions of black kids from all over the world watching you guys as an example and role models.
Yeah, I don't feel like it's a lot of pressure. Not at all. We have pressure on ourselves for just skating for our country, for our families, for just for ourselves. And I think no matter what we do and how we skate, I think that we can represent all the other black children, and we can represent them just being at the Olympics and have reached this level already.
If I know nothing about this sport technically, what do you guys offer as a pair that I'm not going to see from another pair of skaters?
I think it is our athleticism and our color on the ice. I mean, it does stand out. It's beautiful against the white ice. And we're very athletic. We have very muscular bodies, and some of our throws are the best in the world. They're very high, and Yannick is very muscular, very strong, and
he's
our
tall.
Lifts are very good. So I think it's more that than anything else.
Would you agree with that, Yannick?
Yes, I totally agree with that.
Well, you guys make a very handsome pair. Vanessa James and Yannick Bonner, they're pairs of figure skaters that will be skating for France in the upcoming Olympics. Thanks, and good luck to both of you.
Thank you.
Well, they definitely win the gold medal for confidence, that's for sure. For more of all the people behind the Olympics, you can listen back to our interviews from this week, meet the people we're talking to at the Olympics. Go to our website, thetakeaway.org. And we've been asking you all morning, what event would you want to compete in if you were in the Olympics? Sure looks like fun, doesn't it? You can make up an event of your own as well. Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post it to the website. And while you're there, we've got this special project we've been talking about for the last few days. We need your photos. The Westminster Dog Show is coming up next week, so we're going to have our own dog shows. Send us a photo of your four-legged friend, and we'll judge the best in show with our listeners. Post your photos on our Facebook page. We'll talk about them next week. You can get instructions on how to do all of that at thetakeaway.org. It's you, you and your dog at The Takeaway. And if you check out our Facebook page right now, you can see Celeste's dog. My dog isn't on there. And lots of listener dogs. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Celeste Edley. This is The Takeaway.
And next week's going to be a week for me to take a vacation, I think.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.